A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been on some brutal long-haul flights lately. Dubai to Boston, 14 hours straight. And somewhere over the Atlantic, he got to thinking about the fact that his plane had two or three full crews on board, rotating through mandatory rest, while he was just stuck in seat 34B with a neck pillow. His question is, how did aviation arrive at these incredibly rigorous fatigue management rules, and why don't we see anything like them in the rest of working life? Because the underlying insight that exhausted humans make predictable, dangerous errors doesn't stop being true just because you're at a desk instead of a flight deck. He wants to know how aviation's approach to crew fatigue could be imported into other professions, regardless of what you do for a living. So Daniel sent through 5 questions. What does human factors actually mean in aviation? How did the industry arrive at its fatigue rules? And why are they so strict? Why does crew clocking out disrupt flights? And why is that not a sign the system is broken? Why don't other industries adopt the same principles? And the big one, can any of this transfer to people who aren't flying commercial jets? Today we're going to look at how aviation got here, and what it mean to import that thinking into a world where your boss can email you at 11 p.m. and expect a reply by 8 a.m.
They were exhausted, they made errors, and the plane stalled. That crash is what finally broke the political logjam. Human factors is the recognition that humans are fallible components of any system, and that a safety system which doesn't account for the conditions that make error more likely is fundamentally incomplete. That's the thing about fatigue. It doesn't announce itself. You don't feel progressively worse in a way you can track. What happens is you lose the ability to notice your own degradation.
Which is the exact opposite of how most workplaces operate. In most professions, exhaustion is treated as either a personal failing or a badge of honor. I'm so busy, as a status signal. 17 hours awake, if I remember right.
17 hours sustained wakefulness produces cognitive performance equivalent to a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05%. 24 hours pushes you to roughly 0.10. That's above the legal limit for driving in every state. And the person at 24 hours will tell you they're a little tired, but basically okay. That's the trap. End of discussion. The pilot doesn't get a vote.
Which sounds restrictive, but we'll get to why it's actually the opposite.
The FAA's CURT rule, which finally got updated in 2011 after decades of fighting, sets a maximum flight duty period of 9 to 14 hours depending on start time and number of segments. If you start at 7 in the morning, you get a longer window than if you start at 10 at night, because they've baked in the circadian low point. That period between roughly 2 and 6 in the morning when the human body is screaming at you to be horizontal.
The start time actually changes your legal limit.
Radically. A pilot starting at 2 in the afternoon might get 12 hours. A pilot starting at 2 in the morning gets maybe 8.
Kogan Air Flight 3407.
The body has a hard floor. It hits around 4 in the morning, and no amount of coffee or willpower changes the underlying biology. The NTSB investigation found that the probable cause included the pilot's failure to respond properly to a stall warning. And that's the part that doesn't translate to other industries, because in aviation, the regulator can say no. The FAA doesn't ask United Airlines whether it'd be convenient to limit a pilot's duty day. It tells them, if a flight is delayed and the crew is going to time out, the flight cancels. Full stop. The airline eats the cost, rebooks the passengers, and nobody gets to negotiate with the circadian rhythm.
That's where the passenger experience of crew timed out comes from. Daniel mentioned it. It's a common cause of disruption, and from the passenger side, it feels absurd.
The first officer had commuted overnight from Seattle to Newark. She slept in the crew room at the airport before reporting for duty. And it does happen. A crew's duty clock starts the moment they sign in, not when the plane pushes back. So if there's a delay on the ground, maintenance, weather, whatever, the clock is still running. If they're sitting in the terminal for 3 hours waiting for a storm to clear, those 3 hours count against their flight time. By the time the weather clears, they might not have enough duty time left to complete the flight legally. That's not a loophole, it's the system working as designed.
The system would rather strand 200 passengers than fly them with a crew that's been awake too long.
Because the alternative is Colgan Air. Or go further back. Korean Air 801 in 97, where the captain was operating on what the NTSB described as a significant sleep debt, accumulated over several days. Or the crash of American International Airways Flight 808 in 93, where all three crew members had been awake for more than 20 hours and the plane simply flew into the ground on approach. The wreckage trail is long enough that the industry eventually stopped arguing about whether fatigue mattered and started arguing about where to set the limits.
What actually changed in the 2011 rule?
Several things. First, they reduced the maximum duty day. Second, they introduced the circadian start time adjustment I mentioned. Third, they mandated a minimum 10-hour rest period between duty periods, with the requirement that it include an 8-hour uninterrupted sleep opportunity. Not 8 hours off. 8 hours where you can actually be in a bed, with the lights off, not commuting, not in training, not on standby.
So the hard limits are the blunt instrument, and FRMS is the scalpel.
That's the idea. But here's the mechanism that I think is most important, and it's the one that passengers feel directly. The rule treats fatigue as a probabilistic risk, not a binary state. And in aviation, that's the floor, the minimum. The thing you can't go below. It's also worth noting that these are US rules. EASA, the European regulator, has its own set that's broadly similar but differs in details. And then there's ICAO, which sets global standards through its fatigue risk management system framework. And FRMS is the more sophisticated version of prescriptive limits. Instead of saying, thou shalt not fly more than X hours, it says the operator must demonstrate, with data, that its scheduling practices don't produce dangerous fatigue levels.
So it shifts from hard caps to prove it. So when a crew member reaches their duty time limit mid-route, the airline has to find a replacement or cancel. Passengers see a delay and think something's broken, but the system is working exactly as designed. The alternative is flying with an exhausted crew, which is what killed 50 people in Buffalo.
And that's the reframe that most coverage misses. The disruption isn't a failure of the fatigue rules. It's the fatigue rules doing their job. The failure would be letting the exhausted crew fly.
The rules exist in aviation because there's a regulator with teeth, but also because there's a culture that treats fatigue as a safety hazard rather than a personal failing. In most workplaces, being tired is somewhere between a humble brag and a moral weakness. You're either a hero for pulling the all-nighter, or you're lazy for needing sleep.
The stigma is enormous, and it's one of the things aviation had to deliberately dismantle. There's a concept called just culture that came out of aviation safety research. The idea is that you don't punish people for honest errors, because if you do, they'll hide the errors and you'll stop learning from them.
It's like asking a drunk person to decide if they're okay to drive.
It's exactly like that, and we don't do that. We set a blood alcohol limit and enforce it mechanically. Aviation does the same thing with fatigue. The rule is the breathalyzer.
So aviation has these rules because it learned the hard way. Colgan Air 3407 was the inflection point, but the industry had been accumulating data on fatigue-related incidents for decades. The question Daniel's really asking is, why hasn't everyone else learned the same lesson?
Most workplaces don't have that feedback mechanism. The consequences of fatigue are distributed, delayed, and hard to trace back to the specific night of bad sleep that caused them. The cost of fatigue is invisible and distributed across thousands of small mistakes. Nobody traces the bad quarterly forecast back to the fact that the analyst had been awake for 22 hours. And that's the insidious thing about fatigue and knowledge work. The errors it produces are subtle. It's not like falling asleep at a lathe. It's degraded judgment, narrowed attention, reduced creativity, impaired risk assessment.
The second barrier is cultural. The heroic worker norm, working through exhaustion, is seen as dedication, not dysfunction. I'll sleep when I'm dead. It's a status signal. And the third,
the absence of a clear regulatory trigger. No single crash equivalent to Colgan Air for software engineering or law or consulting. Cognitive tunneling. When you're fatigued, your brain conserves resources by narrowing your attentional field. You fixate on the most salient thing in front of you and lose peripheral awareness.
Healthcare is the closest parallel. and even there the gap is wide.
Outside aviation, it looks like someone grinding away on a spreadsheet at 2 in the morning, making a decision that has downstream consequences they haven't even considered, because their brain has literally walled off the downstream from their awareness. Medical residents working 24-hour shifts make 36% more serious diagnostic errors than those working 16-hour shifts. 36%. These are doctors making decisions about real patients. They feel hyper-focused. That's the cruel part. The brain on fatigue doesn't feel scattered, it feels laser-focused on the wrong thing. It's a state of high confidence and low accuracy.
So even when the data is clear, and the stakes are literally life and death, the culture pushes back, which tells you something about how deep the resistance runs.
That's a structural solution to a cognitive limitation. You don't try to train people out of tunneling, you build a system where someone else is always watching. If you cap residents at 16 hours, you need more residents or you need attending physicians to cover more shifts. Either way, it's expensive. And the second problem is that there's no regulator. Nobody's going to fine your employer for making you work a 16-hour day. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration exists, but it doesn't set duty time limits for knowledge workers.
The costs are externalized. Classic!
But let me pivot to what can actually transfer, because I don't want to just critique other industries. There are principles here that don't require a regulatory mandate. The first is treating fatigue as a design input. And that's hard, because the same cognitive impairment that makes you dangerous also makes you bad at recognizing that you're dangerous.
The second is creating hard stop mechanisms. Not try to go home on time. That's a suggestion. And suggestions don't work when there's pressure. I'm talking about the system locks you out at 10 p.m. Automated deployment cutoffs. So, what does a self-imposed fatigue management system actually look like, if it's going to work?
It has to be rules-based, not feelings-based. You set hard limits in advance when you're rested and capable of making good decisions, and then you follow them mechanically. The aviation model says, I don't ask myself at hour 16 whether I'm still sharp. I made that decision at hour 0 when I set a 12-hour cap. The decision is already made. I'm just executing it.
Pre-commitment. Make sure you're taking care of yourself. Work-life balance is important to us, but the decision about whether to stop working is still yours, and you're making it at 11 p.m. when you're exhausted and there's a deadline tomorrow. Of course you're going to keep working. The system is designed to produce that outcome, and then blame you for it.
Those numbers aren't pulled from aviation. They'd need to be calibrated to the specific demands of the work. But the structure is the same. You didn't fail to push through. The boundary was reached. That's what aviation figured out. The rules aren't there because pilots are weak, and ideally enforced by someone else. This is where the two-pilot model becomes relevant.
I want to push on one thing, though. You said the rules don't ask pilots if they're tired. But in practice, pilots do have some discretion. They can call in fatigued and remove themselves from duty. That's a thing that exists.
In aviation, the first officer has the authority and the obligation to call out fatigue in the captain. It's not a suggestion. It's part of the job. The primary system is the hard limits. The fatigue call is for the edge cases where someone's impaired within the limits, and even then, there's pressure not to use it. Pilots talk about this. Calling in fatigue can affect your reputation, your schedule, your relationships with the crew. The hard limits are what actually protect people, because they don't require anyone to be brave.
Even in the most regulated industry in the world, the gap between the rule and the reality is real.
That's where I think we need to hear from Hilbert, because he's seen that gap up close.
I audited fatigue compliance for cargo airline in 2019. 6 months. My cousin's husband knew someone in HR. I sat in a windowless room in Memphis and reviewed pilot duty logs for violations. The thing nobody talks about is that the pilots themselves hate the fatigue rules. They hate them. Because the rules are based on averages, they assume every pilot degrades at the same rate. And some pilots can operate fine at hour 12. The rule treats them like children. But the reason the rule exists is that the pilots who think they're fine at hour 12 are exactly the ones who crash. The system is designed to protect you from your own overconfidence, and that's deeply insulting to competent professionals.
So the structural conditions that made aviation fatigue rules possible, strong unions, a powerful regulator, catastrophic and visible consequences of failure, don't exist in most other industries.
The Cargill airline had a voluntary overtime program. Voluntary in the sense that nobody put a gun to your head. But pilots who didn't sign up for extra shifts were passed over for promotion. Everyone knew it. The fatigue rules on paper were strict. The fatigue rules in practice were whatever the airline could get away with. My job was to flag discrepancies. I flagged about 40 a month. My manager filed them in a drawer.
And I think the answer starts with treating your own cognitive performance as a finite resource that you manage, rather than an infinite resource that you draw on until it runs out.
The manager's view was that the rules were written by people who'd never flown cargo. Cargo pilots fly at night. That's the job. The circadian disruption is baked in. You can't regulate it away. So you either accept some level of fatigue, or you shut down the cargo industry. He wasn't entirely wrong.
That's the tension, isn't it? The rule says one thing, the operational reality says another, and the gap is where the risk lives.
I kept one of the audit spreadsheets. It's in a box somewhere. The thing I remember most is a pilot who'd flown 6 consecutive night segments, all within the letter of the rule, and his own notes in the margin said, felt fine. He'd written it in pen on the printed log. Felt fine. As if that mattered.
That's exactly the overconfidence the rule is designed to protect against. Felt fine isn't a safety metric.
No. But it's also not nothing. The rule treats every pilot as interchangeable. They're not. Some people degrade faster than others. The FRMS stuff is supposed to capture that, but the cargo airline didn't have FRMS. They had me and a filing cabinet. The gap between the rule and the reality isn't a bug. It's the whole story.
That's a reframe that would break a lot of workplace cultures. I'm not available between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. isn't laziness, it's a safety protocol.
And if you frame it that way, you might actually get somewhere. I make worse decisions when I'm tired, and worse decisions cost you money, is a harder argument for an employer to dismiss than, I'd like more sleep, please. But I don't think that means the principles are worthless. It means the implementation has to account for the gaming.
The gaming is the system. Any rule creates an incentive to work around it. The question is whether the rule reduces harm even with the gaming, and the answer in aviation, even with everything Hilbert just described, is yes. The fatality rate in U.S. commercial aviation since Colgan Air is effectively zero. The rules are working imperfectly.
There's another angle I want to raise before we close. The rise of AI-powered fatigue detection, eye tracking, voice analysis, keystroke patterns. You don't. The forgetting is invisible to you. That's what makes it so dangerous. The second one is reduced error detection. A rested brain has a monitoring function. It's constantly checking your own output for mistakes. Fatigue degrades that function before it degrades the primary task performance. So you're still typing, still talking, still making decisions, but the part of your brain that says, wait, that's not right, has clocked out.
So you're operating without an editor. You don't know what the algorithm is measuring or what threshold it's using. And you can't plan around it.
Multiple studies have shown that sleep-deprived subjects rate their own performance as better than it actually is. They're not just wrong, they're confidently wrong. The trade-off is real.
I think the most radical thing aviation offers isn't the rules themselves or the technology. It's the premise. The premise that exhaustion is a system problem, not a character flaw. I want to go back to something you said earlier about the two-pilot model.
That's harder than it sounds, because the heroic worker norm is deeply embedded. Admitting you're tired feels like admitting you're not committed. The aviation reframe says the opposite. Admitting you're tired is professional. The simplest version is, don't ship anything important without sleeping on it. The overnight gap functions as a poor man's second pilot.
The cutting room floor detail I wanted to mention. The NTSB report on Colgan 3407 noted that the first officer had a head cold during the flight. She'd mentioned it to the captain. It's a forced perspective shift. The rested brain is literally a different evaluator than the tired brain.
In aviation, they formalize this with checklists and cross-verification. The captain doesn't just do the pre-flight checks and trust their own tired brain. They run the checklist, and the first officer verifies each item.
The open question we're left with is this. Which brings us to the checklist episode we did a while back, but I think the fatigue angle is different. The checklist catches errors regardless of their source. It doesn't matter whether you missed the item because you were tired or distracted or just forgot. The checklist catches it either way.
That's the beauty of process-based safety systems. They don't require you to diagnose your own cognitive state. You just follow the process, and the process catches errors that your tired brain would miss. The process is the second pilot. If fatigue-related errors start showing up in liability claims, if a tired engineer's mistake costs a company real money in a lawsuit, the incentives shift. That's how a lot of safety regulation actually happens. One more, the concept of the sterile cockpit. The FAA requires that during critical phases of flight, takeoff, landing, below 10,000 feet, there's no non-essential conversation in the cockpit.
We'll see. In the meantime, the principle stands. Exhaustion is predictable, degradation is measurable, and asking tired people to decide if they're too tired is a design failure. I didn't know that had a name.
Sterile cockpit rule. It's been in place since 1981, and it came out of a series of accidents where crews were distracted during critical phases. The insight is that attention is a finite resource, and during high cognitive load moments, you protect it aggressively.
The equivalent for knowledge work would be no notifications during deep work, no email in the background while you're doing something that requires your full attention.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.